So this is Hilo, Hawaii, September 10th, 2011. Class on Giving Class, Part 2, How to Make Your Ideas Stick. Just a quick review of Part 1. In Part 1, we gave the structure. The structure was, first you meditate on the verse itself, the passage. You find one principle. You explain how that principle is true universally. Then you explain how that principle is true for the members of your audience, for the listeners. And then you persuade them to act upon that principle. And if possible, you have some means by which their action can be reviewed. So that was passage, principle, personalize, persuade, perform. Now that's your framework. So in giving the class, you're going to be first explaining the passage of Shastra. Then you're going to be convincing people of the truth of the principle in general. Then you're going to be convincing people that the principle is true, not just in general, but for them. Then you're going to be asking them to do something based upon that truth. And then if possible, you're going to ask them to have some accountability for what they do. Okay, what tools are you going to use in each of those stages? How are you going to convince people of what the Shastra is saying, of the truth of the principle, of the truth of the personal application, and the value of what you're asking them to do? Of course, the ultimate way that we're going to convince anybody is by our own internal conviction. But what we want to do is we want to have what we're saying stick with our audience. So we're going to be looking now at the work of Chip and Dan Heath, a book called Made to Stick. And we're going to be looking at the process by which people are going to remember and act. So to understand that ideas will be understood and remembered and have a lasting impact, that people will change their behaviors. And we're going to be looking here at several components. This is called the success components. What we're looking at is going to spell the word success. And there's six parts to being successful. All right. So what does a sticky idea do? It means that the audience is going to pay attention. Their minds are not going to be wandering. They're going to understand what we say. They're going to remember what we say. They're going to believe what we say. They're going to care about what we say. And they will have the ability to act upon what we say. So you can see how this relates to our framework. Because we want people to understand the passage from Scripture and remember it. Then as far as our principle and the personalization, we want them to agree and believe. That's really the principle. Pay attention is our original introduction. Understand and remember it has to do with the passage. Agree and believe has to do with the principle. Care has to do with the personalization. And be able to act on it has to do with the persuade. All right, this is the problem. Why we often don't achieve this result of people understanding, remembering, believing, caring, and acting. Because if it's something that we understand very, very well, we may not be able to relate to the audience at their own level. And we may also get lost in a sea of information. I'm sure we've been in classes where the speaker is simply going on and on and on and on with facts. I've been in classes where the speaker is asking us to remember all sorts of Sanskrit terms without having any relationship to any principle or any personalization. But let's look at this curse of knowledge. This is one of the problems that we have in our relationships in general, not just giving class. So we're going to have a little exercise right now. Those of you who are with somebody else, those of you who aren't, you're just going to have to pretend that you are. So those of you who are with a partner, I'd like you to think of a song. Think of some sort of song. It could be a particular bhajan, any song that you're convinced your partner would know. And I want you, while singing the song only in your mind, I want you to tap out the song. So, like, we might go, Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adwaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrindam. Like that. So we're going to pause for a minute, and I want everyone with a partner to be singing the song in your mind. So the only thing your partner is going to hear is this. So I just tapped out the Panchatattva mantra. So that's the only thing that your partner is going to hear. All right, so we're going to take a pause for a minute, and please do this with a partner. All right, so I hope that you all did that. And I'd like those of you who were tapping to think about how well did you think you did and how many of your partners correctly guessed what song you were tapping out. So those of you who didn't have a partner, I'm going to try right here. Right now to tap out a song, okay? And see if you can guess what I'm tapping. So if you can guess what I just tapped out. What I just tapped out was the basic pranam mantra to Srila Prabhupada. So in your partners, if the partner who wasn't tapping can guess what the partner tapped out, and after this workshop you can try this again. So we find that when this is done, half of people think I really tapped out that song well, but only 1 in 40 people are able to guess the song. So why is that? Because when we're tapping, we're not giving enough information for the other people to be able to know the song. There's all sorts of information that's in our head that's not being communicated to the other person. Let's look at something typical here. If someone says, okay, what we want to do is maximize our return on equity. That's what we want to do in our business. So the person who says that, they may understand what they're talking about. But people who aren't at the same level of knowledge haven't a clue. So this is one of the biggest problems that we have, this curse of knowledge, where I know something, I understand something, and I expect that other people are at my same level of understanding. In fact, I'm not even aware that they're not. And so I explain things in a way that makes sense to me, and the other person hasn't got a clue of what I'm talking about. Well, this happens in our human relationships all the time. You know, this is what we call a misunderstanding. We'll even use a word, and we think, okay, I know what that word means. And the other person gets a different meaning of the word than we intended. These sort of misunderstandings are what fuel a lot of mediation sessions. All right, so this most important basic thing to get clear is that what prevents us from giving clear presentations is often this curse of knowledge, that I know something so well that I don't even know anymore that I know it so well. It's just a part of who I am. And I forget that the people I'm talking to may not have the same level of understanding that I have. And therefore, I don't explain things in a way that they can understand and that they can agree with. All right, we're going to look at the first of our six. Now that we've looked at getting rid of the underlying problem, we're going to look at the first of our 6 points in success, the S of success, and that is simple. Okay, simple is very hard to do. We did a lot of work last week with finding the one principle. So, and we made the point that in any Shastric passage, there's going to be many, many, many principles. But whenever we give a presentation, we want to find the one most important idea. And it has to be one idea. One idea. And we want to state it in the most compact way, taking away anything else that's not needed. Again, we want to have it as generally a statement. It should not be a question. All right, let's look at a comparison. When the former president, John F. Kennedy, said his core idea was to put a man on the moon and return him safely by the end of the decade. Or he could have said, our mission is to become the international leader in the space industry through maximum team-centered innovation and strategically targeted aerospace initiatives. So although both of those statements are expressing the core idea, the principle of simple means it has to be both core and compact. Let's look at another example. Suppose I want to explain to you about a fruit called a pomelo. So I could give you the core idea. I could say a pomelo is the largest citrus fruit. The rind is very thick but soft and easy to peel away. The resultant fruit has a light yellow to coral pink flesh and can vary from juicy to slightly dry and from seductively spicy sweet to tangy and tart. Now, in one sense, you could say that's the essential definition of a pomelo. But suppose I asked you, do you think that a pomelo would taste good mixed half and half with orange juice? Would you be able to answer that question based on this core concept? Suppose instead this was the core concept. A pomelo is basically a supersized grapefruit with a very thick and soft rind. And here's a picture of a pomelo. So you can see that the second way of stating the core concept is actually what we call simple. It's both core and compact. And the second way has an additional advantage. It's tying us to a concept we already know, that of grapefruit. Here's another example of what we mean by simple. So let's say this is your information you're going to use to come up with a lead paragraph. Kenneth L. Peters, the principal of Beverly Hills High School, announced today that the entire high school faculty will travel to Sacramento next Thursday for a symposium in new teaching methods. Among the speakers will be anthropologist Margaret Mead, college president Dr. Robert Maynard Hutchins, and California Governor Edmund Pat Brown. So this is from a real exercise given in a journalism class where the professor asked the students, okay, write the first sentence of the article. What's the most important concept here? What's simple? What's our core compact concept? And they're all writing away. And if we had time, I would ask you to do this as well. And then the professor says, you know what the lead should be? There'll be no school next Thursday. That's the point. The point of the fact that all of the faculty, the entire high school faculty, will travel to Sacramento next Thursday. What's the point if the whole school faculty goes, there's going to be no school next Thursday? That's the point. That's the simple concept. Now, this is a hard thing to do. You know, we were struggling a little bit with this last week. How do you come? What is the core concept that I'm trying to communicate? What is the core concept in this passage of scripture that I want to communicate? Or what's the core concept if I'm able to choose my own theme for a class? What is the most important idea, the one most important idea in a simple way? Now, how to share that core concept? One way to share it is like Proverbs. You know, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. That's simple. It's a principle. It's a core concept shared in a compact way. Or the golden rule. Do unto others the way you want them to do unto you. The next example given is there's a small town paper that is so successful that I think it's about 120% of the people in a town buy that paper. Now, how's that possible? That means that there's more than one paper being sold to a household. Though there's practically no other paper that has that kind of distribution. And how do they do it? The head of the paper said his core concept is names, names, names. Give me names, names, names of local people. That's his core concept. Sometimes you can have a visual core concept. When people wanted to develop the Palm Pilot, the director got a block of wood that was the size of what he wanted to develop and handed that out. We talked about the pomelo, where you can attach the core concept to some existing idea like a grapefruit. Or what, a core concept can also be what we call a generative analogy. So in the Disney world, they don't call the employees. They call them cast members. You don't interview for a job there. You audition for a job. You're not at work. You're on stage. So they're able to communicate their core idea through a generative analogy. All right, we think of Mahaprabhu doing this with the Bhakti Lata Beej. All right, how do we find this core? We can think of the commander's intent. So at a particular battle, the commander will say, all right, my intent is to capture that hill over there. Just the core idea and really prioritization. There's another seminar I give on the law of retention. And what we do there is we really go through what's most important, what's most important, what's most important, what's most important, getting rid of anything that's not the core. You think about if you had some gold mixed with other things and dirt and you're sifting it, right? First you sift out the big pieces, then the smaller, then the smaller, then the smaller. Finally, you get down to the core. Another example of simple is Southwest Airlines. We say we want to be the low-fare airline. See, when you have a simple concept like that, then it automatically helps you make all kinds of other decisions. This morning I was listening to Jiva Dharma. Started listening to it yesterday at Honor Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And I decided to listen to a section where Bhaktivinoda Thakur is writing about the holy name. So today, in honor of Haridas Thakur's disappearance, I thought it was appropriate to keep listening to the section on Harinam. And in Jiva Dharma, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is writing that the core service is to chant the holy name. That among all, that all the 64 items of devotional service can be categorized into 9 items, and all of those 9 items can be accomplished just by chanting. Then he also explained that when one's doing other items, that they can all be considered part of one's service to the holy name. So he's whittling it down, whittling it down, whittling it down to the core idea. You can think about the inverted pyramid of journalism, where you say the most important thing first. And if you've got 3 things, you're not saying anything. We have the example of it's the economy, stupid, as what was used in, I believe, George W. Bush's campaign. No, that was Bill Clinton's campaign for President of the United States. That was his core concept. So you always want to have one core concept. Then to share the core, don't have some complicated way of explaining it. Just come right out and say, there's no school on Thursday. And how do you share it? By using proverbs or by using schemas, by relating to something that people already know. Okay, so the basics of simple is core and compact, relate to what people already know, relating it to the knowledge they already have, and using an analogy that then generates more actions and more understandings. Okay, we're going on to the second part of success, unexpected. Unexpected. Our presentation should have something of the unexpected. Krishna loves doing things that are unexpected. 2 parts to unexpected. One is getting people's attention, and another is holding people's attention. I cannot count how many classes I've been in where the speaker doesn't make any effort at all to get people's attention. And then I've been in a few classes where people make some effort to get people's attention, but they don't make an effort to hold your attention. So our attention is gotten by surprise. And then our attention is held with interest. Oops, sorry, went the wrong way. All right, let's look at surprise. So I'm sure that most of us have been on airplanes and they make the same announcement over and over again, but on Southwest Airline, the person making the announcement made it in a very different way that surprised people, a way that's not usually done, and that got people kind of, paying attention. What did she say? She said, if I can have your attention for a few moments, we sure would love to point out these safety features. If you haven't been in an automobile since 1965, the proper way to fasten your seatbelt is to slide the flat end into the buckle. To unfasten, lift up on the buckle and it will release. And as the song goes, there might be 50 ways to leave your lover, but there are only 6 ways to leave this aircraft. 2 forward exit doors, 2 overwing removable window exits, and 2 aft exit doors. The location of each exit is clearly marked with signs overhead, as well as red and white disco lights along the floor of the aisle. Made you look. So in other words, she presented the safety announcement in a humorous way, which surprised people, and therefore they started paying attention. So there's also an advertisement. And let's see if I can find that for you here. Okay, there's a television commercial for the new Enclave minivan. And it opens with the Enclave sitting in front of a park. A boy holding a football helmet climbs into the minivan, followed by his 2 younger sisters. Introducing the all-new Enclave, begins a woman's voiceover. Dad is behind the wheel and Mom is in the passenger seat. Cup holders are everywhere. Dad starts the car and pulls away from the curb. It's a minivan to the max, you hear. The minivan cruises slowly through suburban streets. Someone says, with features like remote-controlled sliding rear doors, 150 cable channels, a full sky-view roof, temperature-controlled cup holders, and the 6-point navigation system, it's a minivan for families on the go. The Enclave pulls to a stop at an intersection. The camera zooms in on the boy gazing at a side window that reflects giant leafy trees. Dad pulls into the intersection. That's when it happens. A speeding car barrels into the intersection and broadsides the minivan. There's a terrifying collision with metal buckling and explosion of broken glass. The screen fades to black and a message appears. Didn't see that coming? The question fades and is replaced by a statement. No one ever does. With the sound of a stuck horn blazing in the background, a few final words flash on the screen. Buckle up, always. So there actually is no Enclave minivan, and that site, that commercial was developed by the Ad Council to get people to use their seatbelts. Now in the store Nordstrom, where you pay a lot more money for your goods than you'd have to pay anywhere else, people pay that money because they get excellent customer service. And they don't just say, we give excellent customer service. What they do is they tell stories about an employee who wrapped a package that a customer bought at a competing store, Macy's. They tell the story of a Nordstrom employee who goes out and warms a customer's car in the winter while she's shopping. They tell the story of a Nordstrom employee who refunds money for tire change not sold there. That gives much more of a surprise than saying our mission is to provide the best customer service in the industry. You'd say, huh? They're refunding money for tire chains that aren't even sold in their store? That kind of surprise gets your attention. Right? We can think of in the Shastra, the surprise in the 3rd canto, where Lord Kapiladeva explains that even if someone's born in a family of dog eaters, just by chanting the holy name, they become qualified to perform sacrifices. Now, in doing this surprise, you want to avoid gimmickry. There's 2 kinds of gimmickry. One is an unrelated surprise. You know, people will tell funny jokes that have nothing to do with the class, just to get your attention. You know, or some unforeseeable ending. You know, at the end you say, well, okay, it was just all a dream. The way that you want to have surprise and unexpected is you want to have something that captures people's attention, and then at the end you look back and say, oh yeah. So when you see the car crash, then you can understand, oh okay, I can see how everything was leading up to that. It's what we call post-predictable. Right? You couldn't see it coming when it was happening, but when you look back you see, okay, it all makes sense. You don't want to have some ending that's unexpected, but that doesn't make sense. Okay, let's go to the hold interest part. We talked about the surprise part to getting people's interest. Now we're going to go to the hold interest part. And we could take a long time on this, which of course we don't have. But we hold interest by creating a gap, a mental itch. So instead of telling people up front everything that you're going to tell them, you give people a little tease, and then you tell them a little more, and then you tell them a little more. Think of it like a mystery story unfolding, where you keep getting more and more information, and as you're giving more and more information, you're also having a cliffhanger for the next piece of information. Or, you know, a story that's read in serials, where the end of each chapter, there's a cliffhanger for the next. I mean, Krishna does this. Krishna does this in the Bhagavad Gita, when at the end of the chapter, he tells Arjuna, just leave all abominable actions far distant and engage yourself in Buddha Yoga. And Arjuna's like, oh, wait a minute. You just told me to act. You just told me to act in Karma Yoga. And then you're telling me to leave all abominable actions far distant, engage in Buddha Yoga. Well, this war seems pretty abominable. I guess I should leave it far distant and just go to the woods and meditate. And we find Krishna over and over again leaves things on a cliffhanger, which then forces Arjuna to ask a question. Same thing goes on in the Bhagavatam. And we find that as we're reading the scripture, the same kind of thing happens. We read the scripture, we understand some things, but what I understand opens up another question. And when I get the answer to that question, it then opens up another question. And that way it keeps my interest. Krishna doesn't just show everything. He's constantly expanding and dynamic. So a class should also be like that, that constantly throughout the class, the listeners are going to know, yes, and then what? Yes, and then what? Yes, okay, I got that. And well, what about this? And what about this? Okay, putting together the first two, simple and unexpected. So you want to identify the central message and then figure out what's counterintuitive about the message. What are the unexpected implications? I mean, after all, you're trying to convince people to do something that isn't already happening. Why is that? I've been working for a while with the Devotee Care Committee of the GBC, and we're trying to come up with some kind of a core message. And we want to communicate the idea, among other things, that everybody who's a member of ISKCON should be caring for everyone who's a member of ISKCON. So we've suggested having the core unexpected, both simple and unexpected idea of I am ISKCON and I care. Because often if we think about ISKCON, we think ISKCON is something other than me. ISKCON is some institution. Or ISKCON is the GBC. Or ISKCON, the GBC, the temple presidents. And then if we think about caring for devotees, we'll say, well, they should be caring for devotees. They are ISKCON. So we want to break that idea. Right? We want to see the reason care is not happening is if everybody thinks it's everybody else's responsibility. If the temple presidents think it's the GBC's responsibility, and the GBC thinks it's the temple presidents, and the congregation thinks it's the temple president thinks it's the congregation, and therefore it doesn't happen. So if we say, no, I am ISKCON, and I care, it's my business to care. So that's a core message given in a compact way that's unexpected. Oh, I'm ISKCON, with a little logo of a mirror. Okay, and then that's to create that initial surprise, and then to hold interest, to communicate your message in a way that breaks your audience's guessing machines along this critical counterintuitive dimensions. And then gives you a way of solving the problem. Okay, we're going on to the third element, which is concrete. Third element of success, which is concrete. Our presentation should be concrete. And we have two purposes here in concrete, that I'm going to remember something that's concrete better than I'm going to remember something that's abstract. I'll understand something that's concrete better. And I'll be able to act on something concrete better. Not only will I be able to act better, but if I have to do things as a team, team coordination will be easier if everything is extremely clear and concrete. Okay, this is another little exercise. So I'm going to take about 30 seconds here. I'd like all of you to write down as many things as you can think of that are white in color starting now. Okay, hope you all did that. Now I want you to write down as many white things in your refrigerator as you can think of. We'll give you about the same amount of time. Write down as many white things in your refrigerator as you can think of starting now. All right. I hope that you've all done that. Now, what's interesting is that most people can list as many white things in the refrigerator as they can list white things in general, even though our refrigerators do not normally encompass a large part of the universe. Why is that? Because the white things that are in our refrigerator are concrete. We know about them. Let's see a concrete idea. Here's two examples. If we say we want to have the next great search engine, what does that mean? Right? The next great search engine is abstract. If I say we need a search engine that will become have completeness and speed, those are more concrete. If I say I want to have the next great airplane, that's abstract. If I say it must seat 131 passengers, fly nonstop from Miami to New York City, and land on a particular runway, which has a particular size, that's a very concrete description. We often find in our human relations that this lack of concreteness causes misunderstanding. I was talking with some devotees a while back, and one of them was saying, I wish that my kids wouldn't complain. When they complain, I don't feel appreciated. And I said, okay, fine. Are they ever allowed to say they don't like anything? Are they ever allowed to give any constructive criticism? And she said, sure. And I said, well, how do you know the difference? Oh, I just know. How do you know? Give a concrete way that you know that somebody is giving constructive criticism, or somebody is just informing you about a problem, or somebody is just complaining to complain. So you have to have something that's very concrete. Whatever we want to communicate, it should be as concrete as possible. Concrete means something I can see with a camera or hear with a microphone. I can see with a camera or hear with a microphone. How do we help people understand and remember? We can have the concreteness of a fable, like the fox jumping for the grapes. Why do these fables continue? Because they are concrete. If I just say to you, people tend to criticize what they can't have, you might not remember that. You might not even understand it. But if I give you this concrete example, there's this fox jumping for the grapes, and when he can't reach them, he said, oh, the grapes are sour anyway. Provide a concrete context. In Asia, when teachers teach math, they actually put little blocks or little stones on the students' desks and have them subtract with objects, not just talking about the ideas. They have them actually see and feel the objects. Very powerful. You can make it a story about people. In one university, when they teach accounting, what they do is they create a story about some people who started their own business, like a soap opera story. And all through the semester, as people are doing accounting, they're going through this story. That's to help people remember. Now to help people act. We have the example that there's the planners, the people who create the architects of a machinery, I don't know what you call it, the designers. The people who design the machinery and the people who are using the machinery. So when the people who are using the machinery have a problem, they go up to the designers and say, we're having a problem. And the designers say, okay, let me go look at my drawings. But the drawings aren't concrete to the people on the shop floor. The designers have to go down to the shop floor and look at the actual machines and talk the language of the people on the shop floor. Okay, so here's the example again of the airplane. Instead of we're going to build the best passenger plane in the world, be very specific, very concrete. It's going to be a 727. It's going to fly 131 passengers. It's going to be able to fly from Hong Kong to Los Angeles. It's going to be able to land on this runway that's less than 5,000 feet. Or we're going to build a radio you can put in your pocket. In the days of the old radios, when I think it was Sony wanted to come up with a transistor radio, that was their concrete goal. We're going to have a radio you can put in your pocket. All right, another example was a person who had this idea to have tablet computing. And he went to some investors, and he's explaining the concept, and then he just took his maroon portfolio and threw it on the table and said, that's the kind of computer I envision. And immediately people started brainstorming about how to do it. In general, people are more concrete than data. I can relate to people. Right? People are more concrete than data. So use the concreteness of a fable. Make abstraction concrete. Put people into the story. And Velcro theory. As many ways that people can remember. As many different concrete hooks as you can possibly get. You want to find examples that are going to be common to most people. Don't use concrete examples that are only going to be common to some of the people. Have goals in very tangible terms. We want to be able to chant more japa, more rounds, or we want to be able to chant rounds with more concentration and focus. Make things very, something people can touch and feel and see. Or the idea of the maroon portfolio is some sort of common ground where people can say, okay, let's see how we can do this. How can we work together to do this? All right, getting the simple idea is very hard. It takes a lot of work. Finding something unexpected takes some creativity. Saying things in concrete terms is very easy and very effective. But the problem is that we fall back into this curse of knowledge and tend to talk in abstractions, thinking, well, I understand the concrete, so everybody else is going to understand it also. Okay, we're going to go on to the fourth thing, and that is credible or believable. This is our fourth item, the second C in success. If something's credible, then people will believe it. Now, I'm not going to act on something unless I believe it to be true. There's two ways I can believe things. One is external credibility. That means somebody outside myself who I trust believes it. And if they believe it, I'll believe it. Internal credibility, I experience the truth for myself. So we're going to look at both kinds. Okay, external credibility. There's what we call authority and anti-authority. So authority is the expert. Okay, here is a Nityasiddha devotee, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, coming from the spiritual world, and he's saying, chant the holy name. Anti-authority, here is Valmiki, he was a murderer, and he says, chant the holy name. So example of this in the mundane world, authority is going to be the oncologist, the cancer doctor, who tells you that smoking is going to make you sick. Anti-authority is Pam Laffin, the smoker. She started smoking, you know, 3 packs a day when she was 12 years old. And here she's 36, and she's dying from emphysema. And she says to you, hey, don't smoke. So those are two powerful forms of external credibility. Right? The person who's the expert because they have the credentials, they've done the study, and the person who's the expert because they've actually had the experience, positive or negative. All right, let's go to internal credibility. So internal credibility, we're going to look at four things. Using details, putting statistics on a human scale, giving one example that's powerful enough to prove the case, and having a way for people to test things themselves. Now look at each of these one by one. So convincing details. They've done studies that if you present jurors with a story, so you're trying to prove that Mary Smith is a neglectful mother and that the children should be under the custody of the father. If you tell the jurors that Mary Smith's children go to school with cuts and bruises, Or if you tell the jurors, Mary Smith's children go to school with cuts and bruises, and as the nurse was treating one of these cuts, she spilled mercurochrome on herself and stained her clothes. When you add those details, even though the details are superfluous to the point, people are more likely to believe it. There was a dance company that was applying for a grant given for organizations that had diversity. And when they were asked to prove that they had diversity, they said, we have a dancer who started dancing at 73 years old. That kind of detail. It's really interesting. I had an experience just recently where someone had written me an email. It was not a very nice email. And they were challenging me on some things. I heard that this happened and that happened and this happened and this person did this. And when I responded, no, this is this fact and this fact and this fact and this fact, for every single fact, I gave some kind of detail. I said, okay, this is what happened, and it happened at this time in the morning, and it was a cloudy day. I added some detail to each one, even though the detail was not really important. And what I found was, even though I sent the email to a person who generally doesn't get convinced about almost anything, the person was convinced that I was telling the truth. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. It's really interesting that as soon as you add some detail, and we find that the Bhagavatam does this. You know, until studying this, I often wondered, why does the Bhagavatam do this? You know, we have, I believe it's when the demigods are going with Lord Brahma to see Lord Shiva after the Daksha Yajna. And there's this detailed description given of Kailash. Also, sometimes there's detailed descriptions given of the heavenly planets. I mean, we could understand why there would be detailed descriptions given of Vrindavan or Vaikuntha. But why are there detailed descriptions given of Kailas or Indraloka? That kind of detail adds credibility. It aids people's willingness to believe. So you want to make sure your details are true. And if possible, the details should be compelling ones that support your core idea. All right, we're going to look at the next item, which is the human scale principle. So there's a peace organization that works to convince people to fight for the dismantling of all of the nuclear weapons in the world. How are they going to convince people, though? So what they do is they have home parties, and they bring a metal bucket, and they bring a bunch of BBs. So if you don't know what BBs are, they're little metal balls that are used in what's called BB guns. So they take the metal bucket and they take a BB and they put it in the bucket and they say, this is Hiroshima, one bomb. And then they describe the horrors of Hiroshima. How many people died? How many people died immediately? How many people died slowly from radiation poisoning? How many people were sick their whole lives from radiation poisoning? What large of an area it covered? So people are associating the sound of the one BB, you should also note that this is very concrete, the sound of the one BB with this horrific destruction. Then they say, okay, let's look at a nuclear submarine that has 10 bombs. And then they put 10 BBs into the bucket. And then they say, all right, how many nuclear warheads were there in 1985? And they start pouring 5,000 BBs into the bucket. So you just imagine the noise of all these little metal balls hitting the bucket. And it's going on and on and on. So this is a form of internal credibility where people, as they're having this concrete experience, then they come to say, wow, this situation is really out of control. So this is a way of getting credibility by bringing it to a human scale, by taking something that's so big and so hard to get your head around and putting it in a form that you can relate to and believe. Here's another example, the human scale principle. This is from Stephen Covey's book, The Eighth Habit, and he describes a poll of 23,000 employees drawn from many companies and industries. So he gives you the statistics. Only 37% said that they have a clear understanding of what their organization is trying to achieve and why. Only 1 in 5 was enthusiastic about their teams and their organization's goals. Only 1 in 5 said they had a clear line of sight between their tasks and their team's and organization's goals. Only 15% felt that their organization fully enables them to execute key goals. Only 20% fully trusted the organization that they work for. I would guess that these would probably be the same for ISKCON, these statistics. Now, you just read these statistics, and you may say, wow, sounds like there's a problem. But our ability to believe it and to remember it is helped when it's put in a human scale principle. So Covey does it like this. He says, if, say, a soccer team had the same scores, only 4 of the 11 players on the field would know which goal is theirs. Only 2 of the 11 would care. Only 2 of the 11 would know what position they play and know exactly what they are supposed to do. And all except 2 players would, in some way, be competing against their own team members rather than the opponent. So by taking those statistics and putting it down to human scale, it becomes more credible. Okay, next example of credibility is what's called a key test case. So let's say you're Safe Express, which is a courier in India, and you want to convince a customer that they should use you for on-time safe deliveries. Right? In India, there's really a problem with late deliveries that gets lost, broken. So Safe Express says, hey, you know why you can trust us? Because we handled the release of the 5th Harry Potter book. Now, any of you know anything about Harry Potter? There was total secrecy before the release of each book, and the book had to be delivered exactly on time. It couldn't be delivered any earlier because then people might open it and spoil the surprise, and it couldn't be delivered any later because the fans were waiting. So if you can be trusted with the delivery of a Harry Potter book, you can be trusted with anything. That's another way to build credibility. If it can work in this case, it can work for anything. If the holy name will change Jagai and Madai, it will change anybody. If the holy name will change the prostitute that came to cause the fall down of Haridas Thakur, then it will purify anybody. Okay, then people testing for themselves. You can say, hey, read the label yourself. See what's in it for yourself. Or an exercise, like we've done a few exercises here in this workshop. So you say, try it now and see. So I had a very interesting experience with one of my professors in graduate school where he gave a class about the win-win principle. How that when we're negotiating something, when there's a conflict, we should try for everybody to win something. Not that I win at your expense. And we discussed this for about 20 minutes and we all said, yeah, I agree with that. That's what I believe. That's what I do. And then he gave us a very carefully constructed exercise. And the way this professor was, I don't know, he did this sort of thing all the time, but we never figured it out. He gave us an exercise to do, which was rigged in such a way that the only way everybody could win was for everybody to get 0. That if you tried to get even 1 point, your opponent had to get a negative 1 point. And all he said is, okay, I want you to get in groups, and each group has to try to get their own team colors through. And we went through this exercise for 30 minutes, and none of us came up with a win-win solution. We all got stymied in win-lose. And I was so affected after that class, I thought, wow, I might say I believe in win-win, but I don't really believe in that at all. What's my real beliefs? I became convinced of the truth of the problem by having my own experience, by experiencing myself. That's internal credibility. And many times in giving workshops and seminars, I try to have the participants go through some experience where they will, for themselves, see the truth of what we're teaching. And sometimes we do this in a class with chanting, or with different ways that one can do in a class to have people test in the class, or at least you can ask people to test things after the class. You could say, I suggest you do this and this and this, or you might do this and this and this, and see how that works for you. Try it out and see for yourself. Okay, now we're going to come to the 5th item, and that is emotional. The E in success, that for people to remember and care, this is particularly about caring, things have to appeal to the emotions. So if something is emotional, it makes people care, has 4 parts to it. We make people care, we use the power of association, we appeal to identity, and we appeal to self-interest on a high level. I'm just going to say right now, some of you might be thinking, emotional, hey, you know, I thought we're above that. Actually, bhakti is full of emotion. Those who want to deny emotion are the jnanis, who just want some sort of pure emotionless knowledge. All right, making people care. Mother Teresa said, if I just hear the information, I won't do anything. But if I look at the one, I will act. So people are going to donate much more to Roikia, a 7-year-old girl in Mali, than they are just to Africa. So there was a test done where people were given one of these two scenarios. So some people were told there's food shortages in Malawi. They're affecting more than 3 million children. In Zambia, an estimated 3 million people face hunger. More than 11 million people in Ethiopia need immediate food assistance. Please help. Then another group of people is given this appeal. Rukia is desperately poor and faces the threat of severe hunger or even starvation. Her life will be changed for the better as a result of your gift. This was a study done with people who had been given $5 in cash. Those who were just told the general thing gave an average of $1.14. Those who were asked to give to a particular person gave $2.38, more than double. So, of course, this principle is used by charitable organizations all the time. Sponsor one child, adopt one cow, clean this part of the road. Right, to make it personal, make it emotional. My emotions are not brought out by some large-scale problem. My emotions are brought out by looking at one that I will care about. Okay, another way to bring out emotions is through association. Association. So if I want people to behave properly in sports, I say you got to honor the game. Okay, that brings out my feeling. You got to be careful about this. With association, you don't want to associate things with some overused cliche. Like in our devotee care committee, a number of the leaders said, oh, don't use love and trust. People have heard that over and over again. And if we say that, everybody will just discount it. But if there's something that we already care about, this idea of association, if there's something I already care about, then I can link the new behavior and the new concept that I'm trying to communicate to something that's already there. Right. One example given of an anti-smoking advertisement that showed teenagers throwing body bags full of supposedly dead people in front of a big tobacco company's big tobacco company's factory. And this ad was very effective at getting teenagers to not start smoking or to quit smoking. Why? Because teenagers already have an anti-authority feeling. And by linking the tobacco companies with the existing anti-authority feeling, you were able to bring out their emotions against tobacco. So this is something that we discuss in the Law of Need, how we find people's existing emotions, what they already care about, and we link what we're trying to teach to something that already exists. Okay, another way of having an emotional presentation is with identity. So Texas had a really bad littering problem, one of the worst littering problems in the country. And research showed that the main litterers were young men, you know, throwing beer cans out the window. So they thought, well, what's going to appeal to these young men? If we just simply say, okay, there's going to be penalties for littering, they're not going to care. They're already in an anti-authority mood. So what we're going to do is we're going to appeal to their identity. That basically, hey, you're a young man in Texas, you're a young, tough man in Texas, then you don't litter. And what they did was they took some very well-known Texas sports heroes, and they had advertising campaigns where these Texas sport heroes would get up on television with a beer can and say, look what I found on the side of the road. And the other guy would smash it and say, yeah, when I find the guy who did this, I'm going to tell him something. Oh, what are you going to tell him? I'm going to tell him, don't mess with Texas. And the ad campaign was so effective that within a year, littering was down below that of the other states. Now, why did this work? Actually, the reason why this emotional appeal works is at the heart of our Krishna conscious philosophy. The heart of our philosophy is that our actions are all based on our identity. Therefore, Rupa Goswami says, Sarvapati Vinir Muktantat Partena Nirmala Rishikesha Rishikesha Sevana Bhakti Ruchite. That first I decide who I am. And Prabhupada, at least on one occasion, was asking devotees, how do you preach? They say, we preach that there's a God. God exists. Krishna is God. Prabhupada says, no. You start with that you are not this body, that you are a spiritual soul. Because really, and this is, again, a very long discussion, which we don't have time to get into in depth right now, but we don't really make decisions in life based upon weighing the pros and the cons. We really make decisions by saying, okay, who am I? What kind of person am I? And what is the right thing for a person like me to do in this situation? It's almost as if we have an idealized concept of ourself, and we try to act in such a way as to realize that ideal. Okay, well, I'm a mother. You know, I'm a good mother. What does a good mother do in this situation? Or I'm a responsible employee. What does a responsible employee do in this situation? Or, you know, I'm a disciple. I'm a disciple of Srila Prabhupada. I'm a disciple of such and such person. What does a disciple of this person do in this situation? And that's how we make our decisions. So if we can appeal to people's identity, what is someone like you? Prabhupada did this, of course. You're born in, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did this. You're born in India. You're an Indian. What does an Indian do? Pada Upakar. A real Indian should be out there preaching Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada did this with Americans. He'd say, you Americans, you'll be useless if you don't use your money and your expertise to spread Krishna consciousness. You're an American, that means you're the leader of the world. That means you're rich. That means you're intelligent. You have to do something wonderful for Krishna. Right? There's sort of an appeal to identity. Now, appeal to self-interest. This is often understood, misunderstood, this idea of wifi, what's in it for me? Right? What is the benefit of the benefit? Okay, so if you chant Hare Krishna, you'll realize yourself. Well, so? What good will that do me? I can't count how many articles submitted to Back to Godhead. I have to say, what's the point? What's the benefit? How does this relate to people? What are they going to get out of it? Okay, fine. If I follow a codicil, I'll be free from sinful reactions. So what? What's the benefit of the benefit? How does that help me? So if I give money, I'll help build the temple. So what? What's the benefit of the benefit? What are we building a temple for? Please don't think it's obvious. That's the curse of knowledge again. Well, it's obvious. Maybe to you, but maybe not to the people to whom you're speaking. In doing this, we want to look at Maslow's higher needs. And we'll get to that in a minute. Okay, so people are going to ask, what's in it for me? How are we going to use this? How are we ever going to use this? So let's look at offering people a $1,000 bonus. You could say, oh, this $1,000 bonus means you could put a down payment on a new car or home improvement. You could save it. Or it could mean the company recognizes how important you are to its overall performance. We don't spend money for nothing. Now, it's really interesting when people are asked which of these they would use to try to convince somebody, they usually pick one or two. Why don't you work for this money because you can spend it on what you want, or why don't you work for this money so you can save it? But when the same people are asked, what would motivate you, they pick the third one. They say, what would motivate me was knowing that that money was symbolic of the company thinking well of me. The truth is that most of us are truly motivated by higher things. Most of us are not motivated by lower things. Maslow had what he called a hierarchy of needs, physiological things like air, food, water, safety, love and belonging, esteem, and what he called self-actualization. Self-actualization, where you really feel that you're achieving your destiny and who you are. Honestly, most people are motivated by the top two things in Maslow's pyramid. Now, Maslow had his theory was a good one, except that he said that people won't go for the top ones unless they've had the bottom ones. So that's true in extreme cases. Like Prabhupada said, if people are starving, they can't listen to philosophy. But the fact is that people can even be impoverished on the lower levels and still be interested in the higher things. If you're going to make an emotional appeal to people's self-interest, go for their higher self, not their lower self. Go for their higher self. Don't make an emotional appeal that if you give this money, you'll get your name put up in the hallway on a plaque. But if you give this money, you're going to be part of something bigger than yourself. You're going to be one of the people who's put the bricks in the temple that's going to be benefiting people for the next 200 years. Okay. This is the problem with Maslow's basement. Avoid the basement and don't assume that other people care at the same level that you do. All right, the summary of emotional. So make people care. If I look at one, I will act. Use association. Use something people already care about and link it with that. Appeal to people's identity and appear to people's self-interest. All right, we're going to go on to our sixth and last point, the second to last essence, success, stories. So by using stories as examples, which of course are done all throughout the scripture, the Bhagavad Gita is just one story after another after another. Bhagavad Gita is in a story. Chaitanya Charitamrita is full of stories. What happens when we hear a story? Very interesting thing happens. I've discussed this before. When we hear a story, our brain is going along with that story as if we were doing the actions ourselves. So when the person in the story does something, my brain is behaving as if I was doing that thing. Even the muscles in my body are behaving that way. You ever seen people watch a movie and they're having reactions in their body as if they were experiencing what was going on in the movie? Or somebody reading a book, right? If the character is in a difficult situation, the person reading or watching will start to perspire. And people who are athletes, one of the ways that they train is they mentally go through the plays before they do it physically. I believe the statistics is that you get 2/3 of the muscular benefit by imagining you're doing it as by doing it. So when you hear a story, you get 2 benefits. One is it gives you a map for action. You know how to do it. And you don't just know how to do it theoretically. It's not just gyan, it's vigyan. Because just the act of hearing the story, you are simulating the action. It also gives you the inspiration for action. So it gives you what to do, and it gives you some impetus to do it. If that person can do it, so can I. Inspirational stories are basically of 3 types, which we'll go through in a moment. Okay, so stories work as stimulations. They take us through the process. Thinking about getting that ball in the basket, going through the steps mentally of getting the ball in the basket, prepares you for actually getting the ball in the basket and takes your muscles through the same thing that they have to do to actually get the ball in the basket. Now, here was an interesting story. This is a true story. This man, Jared, who wanted to lose a lot of weight, and he heard that this one restaurant had special sandwiches that were very low in fat. And so he increased his walking, and he ate these low-fat sandwiches, and he lost like 200 pounds. So that was a very inspirational story. People can understand, oh, okay, this is how I can diet. If this guy could do it, I could do it. Let's look at the 3 kinds of stories: challenge, connection, and creativity. Challenge, connection, and creativity. Challenge is David and Goliath, the little guy who knocks down the big giant. The 70-year-old man coming from India with 40 rupees in his pocket, who spoke English with a heavy accent, who'd already had some heart attacks, and who started to bring down materialistic civilization. Challenge. Somebody who had a huge challenge and they overcame it. Good Samaritan. Good Samaritan. The story of the Good Samaritan Jesus tells is that a man had been accosted by robbers, was bleeding on the side of the road, and so many people walk by and ignore him, but the Samaritan helped them. And the Samaritan in his society was like an outcast. So there was a connection made between the outcast and the man on the road because of an emergency. So inspiring stories are also where people bridge some kind of gap. Where the Westerners are chanting and dancing the holy name, they bridged a social gap. A social gap, a racial gap, a caste gap. And we see that people are coming together, overcoming some sort of obstacles. And then there's creativity. Creativity stories are where someone has solved a problem using creativity. And one example, there was one company that tested machinery, and normally they had a very long and rigorous process for testing their machinery. But they wanted to have a new casing, and they couldn't decide if they wanted to go with their standard casing of metal or whether they'd be willing to have a casing of plastic. Would the plastic hold up as well as the metal? So the team leader decided that rather than go through their one-year normal testing procedure, he just tied up a piece of that plastic and a piece of metal to the back of a car and dragged the pieces over a parking lot, over a car park, to see what the abrasion would be. And they saw that the plastic held up as well as the metal. So he had a creative way of solving the problem. Right? We think about people like Thomas Edison. They had a difficulty, they solved it in a creative way. They solved it in an out-of-the-box way. Those are the three kinds of inspirational stories. All right, taking a review of our whole stickiness principles, the success formula. Simple. One idea versus 10, and in a compact form. Unexpected, to grab attention and hold attention. Concrete, something you can see, something you can touch, something you can hear, something that you can see with a camera, hear with a microphone. Something that's credible. Are you really better off today? Are you sure? Think about your life. You got that new house. How long did it make you happier? Emotional, for people to feel something, to care. And stories. Like Jared, who lost all his weight eating Subway sandwiches. So a simple, unexpected, concrete, credentialed, emotional story. If something is simple, unexpected, concrete, credible, emotional, and a story, if it's unexpected, people will pay attention. If it's concrete, they'll understand and remember it. If it's credible, they'll agree and believe. If it's emotional, they'll care. If there's a story, they'll be able to act on it. And what is the it? The it is the simple core idea. So I want to thank you very much. There was a lot of material here, which we were covering in a very short amount of time. If you can use any of these within the framework that I taught you last time of passage, principle, personalize, persuade, and perform. And again, you find that here. You find passage is to be able to explain it. Principle is your core idea. I didn't really go over unexpected last time. Getting people to understand, remember it is the passage. To agree or believe is the principle. To care is personalized. To be able to act on it is the persuade. So we could take a little bit of time here for questions and discussion.
Okay, nobody is muted on reconferencing. So if anybody has any questions, either platform, anyone, go ahead.
I have something. Something that it's very nice class. I'm going to go over this again. But something vocabulary. You know, the words that we use also have some. Power for people to understand or not to understand. I just heard a word accosted, you know, the Good Samaritan example, and I probably would have chosen attacked, you know, or something a little simpler. Because it's almost, you know, so according to the vocabulary, your presentation changes.
Yes, that's certainly true. That's, we're talking about association. Remember, we talked about under emotional association that you want to associate what you're teaching with something that people already care about. And you want to be careful because certain words, you know, if you use the word sportsmanship, people like, oh, that's old hat. But if you say, no, we want to honor the game, then people become inspired. So just having a different choice of words may make a difference in people's emotional association. If you say we want to have a society based on love and trust, people say, I heard that before. Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you say we want to have a society where devotees are cared for, then people will say, yeah, you know, that sounds like something that I'm really interested in. Good point. Thank you.
Okay. Mother Ramila, throughout the week, I myself have been trying to incorporate what you taught in the last seminar. This, as you say, really helps to fill out and everything that we learned before. One problem that I found personally was when I got to the persuade principle. Most of the devotees that I'm speaking to are my peers, and when I try and incorporate persuading some kind of action, it doesn't go over well with me or with my audience. I just feel uncomfortable about trying to get an action from my audience. It would be different if we were speaking to inferiors, but I'm talking to peers.
I don't know. I haven't found a problem with it even talking to superiors. As long as it's vague enough so that the person can find their own way, but specific enough so that it's not just some clouds floating in the sky. And it's really respectful of the other people finding their own way. You know, sometimes that comes from offering a broad range of ideas, offering them as suggestions rather than as prescriptions. Things like, we might, you might consider, you might be willing, this could be helpful for you. Rather than, this is what you should do. So we're looking then at language. Let's just say, if you look back at the class I gave in Mayapur, where I got a lot of controversy about whether or not I should give the class rather than the class. But the class was talking about establishing educational institutions all over the world to train children in Krishna consciousness. So in my persuade, I gave people a lot of options. I said, in order to fulfill this desire of Srila Prabhupada, this basically order of Srila Prabhupada, what can we do? Well, we could maybe help start a school, participate in a school, help out with the school. Perhaps we could just go visit a school, just show them that we care. At the very least, we could smile at the children when we see them in the temple room, make them feel welcome, give encouragement to people who have children, and not say disparaging comments. Oh, is that your fourth child? But actually give them encouragement. We can have an attitude that the children are the future of the society. So I'm using a lot of coulds and mights and maybes, and I'm giving a lot of options.
I would like to understand this a little bit further, because I, so to speak, want to own this. In other words, I really want to be convinced. I'm convinced by your class, absolutely. But as far as using this information for myself, just like when you look at a newscast, if it's objective, you respect the information. But if it's subjective, trying to get you to think in a certain way, that's repulsive.
Well, they're talking about someone who's trying to manipulate you.
Yes.
But in one sense, let's take the negative pejorative connotation out of the word manipulate. We are. That's what people are coming to our classes for. They want to be changed. Why are people coming to hear Shastra? They're looking for a transformation. That's what they want. If they didn't want it, they wouldn't be there. And not only do they want a transformation to occur during the class, they want to be able to take something away from the class that they can do. People don't want to sit in a class just to be told how wonderful it would be to have a Krishna conscious school system. They don't want to walk away from the class saying, great idea, yeah, great idea. All right, who's going to do anything about that? What am I supposed to do about that? That's nice. That's not what people want. Their people are coming. They're basically begging for you to give them a way that they can relate what they're hearing to their own life and take some action on it immediately. Even if the action is just a change in their perspective. So that's how you're the servant. Otherwise, how are you a servant? You know, if I go to a doctor, I don't want the doctor to just read me medical theory out of his textbook. You know, I want the doctor to tell me, okay, this is what your problem is or your lack of it, and this is specifically what you should do. That's what I want to know. Okay, well, what do I do? And, of course, it's up to me whether I follow the suggestions. And I'd really like it if a doctor gives me more than one suggestion so that I can choose which one I'm going to apply and choose which one fits me. You know, the kind of thing I don't like is if I really am not looking for that and someone's trying to force it on me, or they're trying to force me in a particular mold that may work for them but doesn't work for me, and saying everybody has to do it this way. I mean, as a simple example of that, oh God, how many Japa workshops have I been to where people give these really prescriptive things that worked for them and say everybody has to do it that way? Well, the way you should chant Japa is you should sit absolutely still without moving a muscle for at least 4 rounds at a time. And, you know, where's that in the Shastra? So maybe that works for you, but is that going to work for everybody? And if you're a mother of young children, forget it. You know, your kid picks up, you know, somehow climbs on the kitchen counter and gets a sharp knife. I can't move till I finish these 4 rounds. I mean, that's not going to work. So those sort of things are a real turnoff. And I think they come from the mentality that I know better than you what's going to work for you. The Atmavan Manyate Jagat, that whatever works for me is what's going to work for you. And I know exactly how to fix your problem. So that's not what persuade is. Persuade is I'm giving people the seeds of ideas that they can develop into their own solutions. And I might suggest some specific things. I always try to suggest more than one, so it doesn't seem that I'm pushing just one thing in particular. I might say some people are helped by sitting completely still for at least 4 rounds at a time. Some people are really helped by chanting all 16 rounds at one time. Some people are really helped by, you know, chanting by the Tulsi tree, which is given in the Shastra, as Prabhupada talks about that. Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about that. Sitting right by a Tulsi tree when you're chanting. Some people are really helped by chanting in their own personal temple room or in a temple room. Some people are really helped by chanting in a room full of devotees chanting. Other people are helped, Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about going in a closet and covering your eyes and ears and being alone. Some people are really helped by that. So we can think about what sort of situation really helps me focus. You know, what is it that I personally have to do? Maybe I need to make sure my computer and my mobile phone are off. Maybe I need to make sure I'm chanting at a time of the day when the kids are sleeping. Maybe I need to make sure, you know, look in my own life and see what sort of situations really increase my ability to focus and concentrate? Can I do more of that? So that's an example of persuade. I'm giving people a set of options. I'm getting the principle behind the option. And then I'm asking people, maybe we could think about this. What really works for me? Now, what different things have I tried? What works for me? Can I do more of those? Can I do more of those starting tomorrow?
Yes, that was very good. That's a big difference in the way I was thinking.
Right. Now, whereas if I go and say, okay, everybody, look, you know, you really want to improve your japa. I mean, what's wrong with you guys, huh? You know, like you've taken your vows of initiation and your devotees, and your japa still stinks. What's wrong with you guys? Come on. You should be sitting still without moving a muscle for the full 16 rounds and chant those 16 rounds a month. And you better make sure there's a Tulsi plant on one side of you and your deities on the other and a room full of pure devotees. Now do it today. You know, I mean, who's going to want to do that? It's like, hey, get me out of this place. So, you know, I think it's a matter of being respectful and being a guide and just, again, helping, because really, all of us have all of our own solutions within us already. We really already have everything that we need. It's just a question of people helping us to find our own answers and acting much more as a facilitator. That's really even, what is the guru doing? He's opening the eyes that we already have. It's not exactly that he's giving us eyes. We already have the eyes. Bhakti is already within us. Everything we need is within us. So he's helping us to discover. I mean, this is the book that I was working from today. The authors have written another one called Switch, about making changes in your life or in organizations. And they talk about find what's working. Find what's already working and do more of it. Because there's always going to be something that's working. So those are the, I hope that'll help you get some idea of how persuade is something that's respectful. It's something that you can do even with your superiors. Especially when you're giving a class. And frankly, when you're giving a class, that's your duty on the Vyasasan. Once you're on the Vyasasan, you don't think so much like that anymore. You're there representing Vyasadeva. You're there representing Srila Prabhupada. You know, it's not you anymore. It's not, well, who am I and what's my social position anymore? That's really, it's almost irrelevant. You're there acting, that's your service. You're there acting as the via media. And if you don't give people that, you haven't done your service. You know, I can't count how many theoretical classes I've been in where I'm the one after the class who's got to think, okay, what does this have to do with me and what can I do with it? And frankly, I don't usually do it. I don't usually do it. The class is over. I've got other things to do. My day goes on. And I don't usually sit down in a class like that and take the time to say, what does this have to do with me and how can I act on it? Sometimes, but not as a general rule. And if the person giving the class helps me to do that in the class, then I'm very grateful. Okay, anything else?
Hare Krishna, Mother Amrita.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you very much. Yes, I found the whole session, the two sessions very helpful, and I'm sure I'll benefit a lot. And just out of interest, you know, we know Sri Prabhupada was a master class giver, so obviously you've studied his lectures and all that. Do you see him in the lectures incorporating these principles that you have outlined to us?
Absolutely.
Maybe unconsciously, perhaps. Yes.
And I see, not only in Prabhupada's lectures, I see throughout the Shastra and throughout the writings of the Acharyas. That they concentrate on core ideas, which they present often in unexpected ways that kind of shake us up. They provide unfolding mysteries. They give very, very concrete information. They use expert testimony. They use anti-authority testimony. They give us ways that we can test things in our own life. They help us to see specific examples that we're going to care about. They relate things to our own personal associations, and there's tons of stories. So I definitely see all of these. I may not necessarily see all of these in one particular class, but I'm definitely going to see that these things are used, because these are what make people believe and care and change. Believe is with the mind. Care is with the heart, changes with the body. Body, mind, words, thinking, feeling, willing. So a good presentation has to appeal to thinking, feeling, willing. In thinking, I have to believe. In feeling, I have to care. In willing, I have to be able to know what to do, and I have to be inspired to do. So you'll find that throughout Guru Sadhu Shastra, that those are there. Sometimes more elegantly or less elegantly, sometimes more obvious or less obvious, but they're certainly there. And I would guess that anybody who spent some time with Prabhupada's books, Prabhupada's lectures, could be able to list his main core ideas. You're not the body. God is a person. Chanting Hare Krishna is the key. And those are all unexpected core ideas for materialistic people. Anything else? We can have one more.
Well, I was just going to comment that when I first looked at the handouts that you sent out, I was thinking, this is going to be a 10-hour seminar. But I was amazed at how you could cover all of this information in a little bit over, you know, in less than 90 minutes. It was very powerful.
Well, I hope it was helpful. I mean, obviously, we could spend 10 hours on this, and I was also speaking a little fast. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. I'm very grateful. All right.